Jim Gallison. I am a tech writer for a Silicon Valley company, and I have a kind of hobbyist interest in observing political systems and propaganda and anti-science.
This is a continuing episode of a series about fascism and science fiction.
So yeah, other contemporary science fiction treatments of concerns about authoritarianism. You know, we were very worried in the early 70s about overpopulation, you know. And so you had Soylent Green, which was certainly one of the bleakest science fiction films based on the novel Make Room, Make Room, right?
Oh, right.
And that was unrelentingly grim and had the unfortunate feature that it was Edward G. Robinson's final film. Oh. And he was dying of cancer, and he died like 2 weeks after they wrapped.
Wow.
And Charlton Heston was his very close friend. So the scene where his character is going home, meaning he was being euthanized, but he's given this, you know, a half hour of pretty visuals of nature that no longer exists. And Charlton Heston is weeping over him. That's not acting. He's totally crying over his soon-to-be-dead friend. So that adds a meta layer of grimness to that film.
Wow.
Then you had Philip K. Dick again. You know, he wrote Radio Free Albemuth. It wasn't published till after his death, and he turned that into the Vallis trilogy. But when he wrote Radio Free Albemuth, he very much had Nixon in mind. So there's a parody character of the President of the United States named Ferris F. Fremont. And so the three letters FFF mean 666, right? So he's commenting on the immediate fascist concerns about, you know, Richard Nixon's policies. And interestingly, his followers, what we would call MAGA today, were called FAPPers, Friends of the American People, the FAP. It's like, I only got that later, the joke that he was writing there. I was like, oh, are you kidding me? He really got away with that? Well, and then, of course, you know, 1977, you had Star Wars, you know, George Lucas, and the Empire is pretty clearly a fascist entity, and, you know, they have a device that can destroy whole planets, so I think that was talking a little bit about fear of nuclear annihilation. You know, there was always this, the 70s and 80s, anybody who lived through that, I mean, really from the 50s through the 80s, there was this constant fear of nuclear annihilation hanging over everyone, which I think is reduced, the fear, I think, today is reduced. Of course, the threat is still there. Mm-hmm. And then also you had John Carpenter, 1988, with the They Live, which was a parody of the Reagan Revolution, which imagines the Reagan Revolution as being engineered by this invading species of aliens who have Rolex watches that they communicate with, which I think is a nice touch.
The Reagan Revolution? Well, tell me more. I don't know that. Understand that background.
Well, the Reagan Revolution was, I mean, you could go on and on about it, but fundamentally, the Reagan Revolution reworked the American tax infrastructure to untax the wealthiest Americans and shift the tax burden down to the middle class and lower.
Oh, okay.
And so this is, I mean, we still live with the results of that today. That's basically when wages stagnated and productivity increased, but wages did not increase in tandem. So it was, you know, it was a power grab. And it was quite successful. And so John Carpenter famously said of that film that it's the scariest film he ever made. And he also said that it's a documentary. Yes.
So that's I saw that film it was made for TV by, I don't remember, it was NBC. Isn't that right? That's the TV series you're talking about.
Oh, I'm talking about the film. I didn't know if there was a series adaptation, but
Okay.
Yeah, the film was released in 1988.
Sorry, I'm getting mixed up with a different one. I was thinking of V.
Probably thinking of V.
Yeah, yeah.
Where the aliens invade and they have the big reptilian mouths and they. I love that show, man. That was a great show when I was a kid. I didn't add that to my list here, but that's certainly invasion by a totalitarian force, doubt.
Well, okay, so John Carpenter, They Live, if I remember right, the hint for this is I believe you needed sunglasses, a certain kind of glasses to see the aliens, because they look indistinguishable otherwise from everyone else. And so it's kind of like in that, remember in The Matrix, that feeling when Neo discovers that he's inside of a machine, but he didn't know he was inside of a machine. It gives you that effect, like, oh my God, they're all around.
It's very similar. In that sense, it's a very similar story. And there is a moment of revelation where the true nature of the world is revealed to the main character, and it's not a happy revelation, right? then let me see. I think the... One of the best examples is Norman Spinrad's novel, The Iron Dream, from 1972. And in it, he writes, I don't want to spoil it, because there is kind of a, when you read through the whole thing, if you can make it through there, there is kind of a reveal at the very end that understand why you've been reading this very purple prose in this very uncomfortable resurrection of Nazism that's imagined in a post-nuclear war future. But even though it's set in the far future, Spinrad is really talking about concerns in the early 70s, again, like around Nixon, of a resurgence of fascism in the world. And Ursula Le Guin reviewed the book and straight up said that Spinrad is trying to tell us that it's happening here, even though she had a lot of criticisms for his writing style and skill. She did appreciate the point he was making. I mean, she's asking, like, how can you read a novel that's designed to be unreadable?
She was complaining about the structure of the novel itself, because I was wondering what you meant, like, why would she criticize him because he's writing as somebody else? Norman Spinrad's writing as, I don't know if we're trying to unspoil it or whatever, but he's writing as somebody else. And so he's got to write in the style of that somebody else. And he's in, and so, yeah.
Which I think works. And I understand Ursula Le Guin's criticism. I mean, some of his earlier writing, just his own novels, are purple. But you got to give him credit for, he wrote one of the best Star Trek, original Star Trek episodes, The Doomsday Machine, which is basically Moby Dick in space. And that's everybody's a Star Trek fan, at least, loves that episode. And then he wrote another novel, I think it was 1982, called The Void Captain's Tale, which is just a delightful exercise in imagining a future language. And so he mashes together languages from all over the world in a way that's really fun to read and totally works. It's totally believable, I thought. So I think that Ursula Le Guin's criticisms are a little harsh.
What's his Andor? Is that the new Disney Channel series of some kind?
Yes, that is the new Disney series. It's basically a prequel to the film Rogue One. And starring some of the characters who appeared in Rogue One. And it might have, I don't know, I haven't watched all of season two yet, and it might have a bit of a dramatic problem. And then, of course, at the end of Rogue One, everybody dies. So I don't know if I should spoil that, but so I don't know if all of these characters, like, oh, well, it's working for me, though. And it's an explicit comparison to the current situation with out-of-control xenophobia.
Oh, cool.
And it's very explicit. And so it's contemporary science fiction talking about issues that we're dealing with today. So that's fun.
Growing up has never been easy, even in prehistoric Mesopotamia. Young Akia was the runt of a tribe that's legendary for feats of strength. But Akia prefers feats of intelligence. However, that gets him no respect from his peers. He gets into more trouble when he accidentally disrupts his tribe's corner on the market of hauling goods due to his invention of using levers. This idea becomes so popular that the neighboring tribes no longer require his own tribe's services. To make matters even worse, music television marketers from the future are meddling with the culture of the region. At first, Akiya is excited by the strangers, but then realizes that there is a danger in becoming dependent on their gifts. But the stranger's pull is drawing the youth away from all of the tribes. So Akiya must find a way to save his people, join the music television marketers with their technological magic, or join with his elders who had rejected him. Caveman Funk, a novelette by Lancer Kind, is available on Amazon Kindle. Check out the show notes because we have got an amazing plethora of information that you will be interested in. We have visualizations of fascism over time. We have tables of how science fiction rates it, different levels of fascism. And we have, of course, our very own United States of America rated there with a graph on the increasing levels of fascism. The series started at episode 337. If you missed that first episode, like my friend Kevin, you can find all of the episodes by going back to scifithoughts.space, and you can type in the episode number of what you're missing, and the search engine will find it for you. Next episode, more Jim Gallison.
Now we're going to move into speculative, it looks like.
Yeah, this is the realm where you imagine science fiction should really shine, right? This is where authors are imagining, well, we know what fascism looked like. And we have an idea of what it looks like today, but what forms might it take in the future, right? What might be the sort of driving ideology that makes a society fascist in the future?